Hi, Kerry. Welcome to the Life in Recovery podcast.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
Lovely to meet you. If you'd like to just give us a little bit of background as to kind of what you do now, kind of for a living and how you kind of ended up there, really.
Okay, so what I do, so I'm the Director of Operations for the Well Community, CIC. So we're a LERA, we're a Lived Experience Recovery Organisation, which essentially means that the majority, I think, probably about 95% of our staffing team are actually in recovery from drug and alcohol abuse, mental health, kind of criminal lifestyles, criminal backgrounds. I'm also in recovery, so I've been clean 17 years. I was a heroin addict and alcoholic up until the age of 30, so from 15 to 30. I think the motivation to really work in this field kind of came from my own experience of services, my own experience of clinicians, kind of people trying to tell me what was wrong with me, but never truly finding out what was wrong with me till I kind of got amongst people who had worked out what was wrong with them. I think the journey for me was quite a tough one. I think it just kind of reinforced the negative self-beliefs that I had. It's like I didn't seem to be able to get anything right. I didn't seem to be able to stop using. I couldn't regulate what I was using. I couldn't do a drinks diary. I couldn't just not use. I couldn't just stick to my script. It's like I just couldn't do anything, and I couldn't understand because I've always had a brain, you see. So on the one hand, I've had quite a big brain that I've used quite well, but on the other hand, I was a raging heroin addict, and I just couldn't stop using, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't apply that same thinking. So for us, for the Well, I mean, I was involved right from the start of with us setting up this organisation. It was set up by Dave Higham, our CEO. Again, big background, criminality, drug use, and really struggled to find the right solutions. So we kind of like thought collectively we might be able to contribute to the treatment system really, and really offer that lived experience approach, which we've managed to do quite effectively over the last 11 years. So yeah.
Amazing. I mean, it's miraculous to think that you went from where you've come, basically, a heroin
Yeah.
addict to where you are today. But you've just like really pricked my ears up because the last conversation that, well, I'll probably speak about this in every podcast, but you pricked my ears up because you said about, clinicians trying to tell you what was wrong with you. So in your experience and in your own words, what did you think was wrong with you? What is the problem of addict? Why do people become addicts?
What I thought was wrong with me, and now I know what was wrong with me, are two completely different things. So what I thought was wrong with me is that I was a bad person, I was defective, my actions could never match my intentions. I mean, I had two children in my addiction. I thought I was a terrible mother. I thought I didn't love enough. I thought fundamentally, there was just something wrong with me. I never for a moment, which is quite frightening when I look back, I never really thought that the issue was the drugs or the alcohol. I thought the issue was me. I'd not put two and two together that if actually I drink, I can't stop drinking, because I genuinely believed I could. I really thought it was a matter of will and it was a matter of character. Despite all evidence to the contrary, I still really believed it was a lack in character and a lack on my part. What I've since come to realize is it was a solution. Drugs and alcohol were a solution for me. I'd had a lot of trauma, a hell of a lot of trauma growing up, and I got so much ease and comfort really from heroin, that it was a solution to that problem. So I think, yeah, that's really, I think I was self-medicating. I was self-medicating. And then even when I went on the journey to in recovery, the recovery pathway that I chose, I still wasn't really encouraged to ask why questions. Well, I have a brain, so I'm always going to ask why. So I think in the first instance, I think my recovery was just about realignment, maybe being able to have some congruence to what I was thinking and what I was feeling, matching my actions up. But there came a point where that weren't enough. So I kind of went down a psychotherapeutic route and, really went in there and had a good dig around, to find out really how I do operate, why I'm triggered the way that I am, why I think the way that I think, why I act, in the ways that I do. And I found a whole pool of pain there. And fully understood why I was an addict, because it was a solution to the pain. It was an anesthetic. And then now I've kind of continued with the psychotherapeutic journey. And I do that every month, and started training to become a psychotherapist myself, because I personally believe, we do need to go in and have a bit of a dig around and find out why we do what we do. Like CBT therapies, anything in the moment, it's like I'm not up there. It's like I need to be in my body. Do you know what I mean? Recovery for me is about being in my body, I suppose. So it's there's generally quite deep reasons. So it's important for me that I understand. And then I think as well, it's to bring about change for my family. Addiction and alcoholism is systemic. There can be workaholism, there can be alcoholism, there can be abuse that runs right through families. And sometimes we just inherit what the last generation, just kind of like passed down to us. And I always feel incredibly grateful that I was a heroin addict, because had I just been an alcoholic, I imagine I would just still be an alcoholic today. I think it had to show up quite different in my family system. Now, my family do struggle with alcohol, but it's kind of acceptable. We're a working class family, we go out, we have a pint, there's drink for everything, and that's all right. But then I came along and I was a heroin addict, and that kind of threw a grenade, into the middle of my system, because it was completely unacceptable. So I'm always grateful that I was, because it had to be something quite far out and quite really abnormal and outlandish, for me to recognize that what I was doing was possibly wrong. And then that way I could make some changes.
So we're singing from the same hymn sheet, because basically what I always say is that the drugs, well, any addictive behaviors or substances are the medicine. That's the medication, the way that we medicate ourselves, isn't it?
That's
The
right.
pain and the trauma. If you don't mind me asking, you may or may not want to go into this, but what kind of trauma did you suffer when you were a child?
Abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect, emotional abuse from a very, very young age, from a very young age until I left home at 18. So I left home at 18 with a baby. So it had been a harsh environment, a really, really harsh environment. So when I found heroin at 15, well, I'd first found ecstasy and trips. I used to babysit all week to get my money to get to the clubs, you see, because I was going to clubs way too young. But it was absolutely an escape. And then part of the clubbing scene, late 80s, early 90s, the come down part of that was heroin. That's where the heroin came into it. And I think that's where a lot of people accidentally kind of fell into it, as like, this sort of party scene, as a way of coming down and feeling better. But I genuinely felt like I'd landed. It was like just the rest that I got, at first, the rest that my body got, the rest that my mind got, how easily I could sleep and, switch my mind off. And I suppose it, for someone like me, I feel it's no wonder, when I see people who come into the service that we've got, and I see homeless people, it's like it's no wonder. Once you hear people's stories, you really, really wouldn't be surprised, that's what they will be doing on a daily basis, to make life a little bit more bearable. So my story is no different. It really is no different at all. It's just had a probably quite a different outcome, than a lot of people's.
I was only saying this to my friend Adam the other night, that he was sort of talking about someone that he knew that was a heroin addict. And I said, he said, oh yeah, but she grew up in a lovely household. I said, yeah, but you don't know that. You think from the outside looking in, it may look like, like Swiss Family Robinson, but you never know
Absolutely.
what's going on behind closed doors. There's
No.
always, I've never ever heard anybody tell a story of addiction that doesn't begin with some sort of trauma.
That's it. And it can be, I mean, what I find traumatic and what you find traumatic can be two completely different things. I mean, amongst all that, I sat the grammar school test when I was 11 years old and I didn't get in. And that was one of the most traumatic things, because the pressure from my family, so as I say, I've always had a brain, the pressure from my family and the letdown, that drove me, that just drove me and drove me and drove me, to achieve and succeed and to study and do better. And Really, I suppose I struggled with self-esteem, a lot of my life, but I always strived, to be the cleverest one, to know the most in a subject, to achieve more than the next person. And it wasn't until I was in therapy about 5 years ago that I actually realized what an impact that had had. Now, you wouldn't think not passing a grammar school test would actually send anyone down any sort of path, except in a moment you might be a bit pissed off and then you'll go to, another high school. But what that signified for me is there's parts of the world that I'll never be allowed into, there's institutions that are closed off to me, there are certain groups of people, that won't want to be my friends. So I always had this propensity to really make myself small because that's how I'd internalize that whole process. So I don't really think it's till you start digging around. And like I say, what was traumatic for me, it could have been a blessing for the next person, but that's households for you. I also think birth order. I was the eldest of four. There was a lot of responsibility placed on my shoulders, more than what there is on, my younger brothers. So even that in and of itself, what the expectation is of you in a family system, or the roles of girls and the roles of boys, well, that can be really traumatic. But we don't really know till we kind of get in and have a look around, do we?
Very subjective, isn't it? I mean, it's funny because I actually passed the grammar school test. I didn't go to the grammar school because I didn't want to go to the grammar
You didn't
school.
want to go. I did.
It's funny, but it's funny like that how that is like, you're saying like one thing for one person. We have all these experiences when we're young, and the guy that I was last speaking to was saying, he had brothers who didn't turn out the way he did, but
Doesn't matter.
it doesn't matter, does it? It doesn't matter. What
No,
matters
but
is
I think what happens is his family's scapegoat. So I think I see it and I hear it all the time. Like, here's the special one, here's the one that behaves. I'm not a bad parent because look how this one behaves. But what we don't recognize is with each child, everyone's born into a different family. So as a first child, you've got your parents to yourself. As a second child, you're kind of pushed out of the way. As a third child, your parents probably give less and less of a crap about birthdays if you've fallen, if you need to do it. Do you get what I'm saying? Because the parents change. So we're always born into different families, into completely different parents. But a lot of people don't factor that stuff into a child's experience in the family home.
Yeah, very true. Have you so you start talking about like digging around and what you've uncovered. So did that start off with therapy, counseling? How did that kind of come
Yeah,
about?
therapy. It started off, I had been in mutual aid fellowships for about 11 years, and I was just so dissatisfied. I felt like there was a glass ceiling. I felt like I needed to achieve. I needed a space where I could be big. And I felt really, really hemmed in, and that's not the message, and that's absolutely fine. But I sat really uncomfortable for about a year thinking I need to leave, I need to leave. But people don't leave. What happens to people? Well, you die. Well, you don't die. The truth of the matter is you don't die. And I got a really strong faith. That's one thing that I got. I got a really, really, really solid faith. And it was almost like a walking faith, walking out. I kind of walked in to find it, and I left with it. And I didn't really know what I was going to do. But within about 9 months of leaving, there was this kind of certain kind of psychotherapy, that had dropped on my lap, and there was a few people that I'd seen that were doing it, and we actually looked up to, I admired the way that they spoke, the way that they carried themselves, the way that they conceptualized things. So yeah, I kind of started on that journey with some retreats, with kind of like some groups, and then I started training to be a psychotherapist myself, and continued. I see a therapist every month. Same therapist every month. I really, really couldn't survive without it because this is the evolution. And I know as an addict, as an ex-addict, ex-alcoholic, addiction is about being stuck. Well, I can get stuck today. I don't have to take drugs and drink to feel stuck. And I think what it does is it moves me through stuff because with it's like I put myself out there. I've got lots of friends. I've got a really good social life. The job that I do means that I'm in touch with kind of really important people, I mean, we're all really important, but maybe people who've got positions and one thing or another, and then it might be somebody who walks through the door and who really, really needs help. Well, the human experience of that for me is I can still be triggered. I can still be triggered by that. I can still feel less than. I can still feel like I might not want to help. I might want to help too much. Somebody's trauma might trigger my trauma. I think as I grow professionally, I still need a framework, for who I want to be in it and how I'm going to grow. So I think the psychotherapy still keeps me moving. Because I think when you've got wounds, sometimes they can be bandaged to a larger degree, or they can be minimized, but it cannot take much sometimes to trigger existing wounds. And I think if you're in relationship with people, friends, colleagues, romantic, whatever, expect to get your wounds triggered. So, and I don't like being like, I mean, I don't mind because I'm no, I always say you need shit to grow roses. So I know there's good stuff coming, but I can't stand sitting in the, I don't like feeling this way, or feeling at the mercy, like someone can knock me off my perch. I don't like it. I really don't like it. So I think for me and my children, and the role that I'm in, that's kind of like my commitment to the evolution of my family as well. So my children, because they've been brought up around all this stuff, they're really, really emotionally intelligent people, and I love hearing, the stuff that they come out with, and the stuff that's acceptable to them, and they can spot an idiot at 100 paces, so that'll be my legacy to them.
It's interesting that you just used the buzzword for me and emotional intelligence, because I actually, if anybody actually asks me what addiction is, I say it's a lack of emotional intelligence. Because
Lack of
and people say,
resilience, isn't it?
"What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, we have this inability to manage our emotions, and because we're just wrapped up in those emotions, that becomes mental health issues, and then we
Of
medicate
course.
mental health issues with whatever this."
And that for me, internalized anger. This is another reason why I left mutual aid, because nobody teaches you how to deal with anger. So if you're angry and you're a woman, you've not got a leg to stand on, because then you're just an angry woman and nobody wants to talk to you. However, if you in for me, if I internalize anger, then I very quickly get depressed. So I think this is what the psychotherapy has taught me. So I can start to feel the dips and the lows, but I feel anger. I mean, we just need to be taught how to deal with it, to deal with what it means. And what it means to me is it's kind of like the higher part of myself protecting myself. It's a protective mechanism. So when I get angry about something, it's almost like, if you imagine like some bouncers or your wingmen, they come in to kind of like help you out. And I think that's all anger's doing, is going, do you know what? I'm going to take care of you. That is exactly it. But no one really teaches us how to deal with it. And we have to feel angry. I don't think it's an emotion to be feared, but we can see it when people come into services, if they come in angry, or if anyone's maybe shouting at a receptionist or something. Not a lot of people are equipped to deal with it. And we talk that it's bad, and it's really not bad. I mean, I'm not saying we should go around shouting and swearing at people, or we should go around hitting people or anything like that, but we all deserve a space to be angry. Because I think we speak our truest words as well, when we're angry. So yeah,
Yeah,
this is something I needed to learn to deal with and accept.
I mean, it's just scary, isn't it, when you're in that position, somebody's being overtly angry. It's difficult to manage because you unless you're trained, like obviously, like actually just sitting down with somebody and just letting them vent,
That's
usually
it.
enough.
That's it. That is literally it. And I think one of the things that we then don't end up doing is, this is where conditional love starts. So we start to love people conditionally, because it's all right. I love you if you don't do that, and that. And I don't think a lot of homes and a lot of work environments, I don't think we encourage, where we say, all of you, bring yourself, bring all yourself, all of you is welcome. And I think we can do that with our children. We can say, shut up, sit down, do this, do that, don't do this, don't. And it's all messages that we internalize where we have to be good or we have to not make a noise or we don't cry or we don't kick up a fuss. And essentially what we're saying is there's only certain parts of you that I'm prepared to deal with. There's only certain parts of you that are welcome. And then we can have kids that can go and act up outside the home, or they'll go to school and they'll misbehave because they want the attention outside the home, because we seem to create these like incubators where let's behave, let's have everyone behaving, because then we all know what we're doing. And you know, a lot of people who know me, I love uncomfortable conversations, love them, love holding space for them. I just like it, because I just, it's truth and it's honesty. And if you can just get through, if you can get through the journey of that, you always land in a really good space. But a lot of people tend to want to shut stuff down because they can't handle it, they can't deal with it.
What do you think the answer is with kids then? So, like, I've got a 4-year-old, for example, and I've got two teenage daughters as well, 15 and 13. And it isn't easy. It's not easy being a parent, is it?
I
But
mean,
what?
I've got four. I've got a 29-year-old, a 24-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 9-year-old. So, yeah.
You trump me.
Well,
So what's your thoughts on it then? Like managing those emotions in children, what do you think is probably the
let them have
best?
them.
Yeah.
Just let them have them. I mean, they can't regulate. To be fair, my kids can regulate better than most adults. So I suppose we've got to watch what we're putting on children and what we're not really modeling ourselves. I think by nature, they're clumsy, they're messy, they need to move, you know, they can clatter about and they're really quite noisy. And I think, yeah, I just validate. If they feel how they feel, I just validate how they're feeling. I don't try and change how they're feeling. I don't really try and reframe it all that much. I think sometimes it's just about holding space and just letting them say everything that they need to say. I mean, sometimes I might give them a different, you know, way of looking at things, but then you can bring about humiliation sometimes, you know, if you bring that in at the wrong time. Because you don't ever want to feel stupid about how you feel. And I think as kids, we can immediately, I mean, one of the first things we'll do is cover our face to cry. It's like a shame reaction, isn't it? You know, and I'll say to my kids, like, have a big Oscar winner. Do you know what I mean? Move your hands, like scream, like make a noise, and you know, just to be free and just to take up as much space. Because I think another thing that we can do is we can make people small. So especially if we're out and the kids are kicking off, it's like, be small. This, you know, because we don't want attention, and it's just all this messaging where they're not really free. And it's like, I'm not saying for a minute we should have kids who can go around doing what they want when they want, but I think we can have a propensity to try and make people small, fit in, fit in, fit in, shut up, fit in. So
Yeah.
yeah, I my kids, yeah, they're loud, you know that they're there, they're really, really big characters, but they're really, really good people as well. So they know the place, I think. They know the place, and they know what they deserve, and they know exactly how they should be spoken to.
Which is
Yeah. Of
really important.
course it is. I mean, they'll come on from school, and if they tell me a teacher's an idiot, I'd believe them 100%,
Yeah.
because they're so used to being spoke to and treated in a certain way that they know when somebody's not being right with them, or they know when somebody's being off with them, and they know when the fault lies with the teacher.
Yeah.
And they can come home and communicate that. So, yeah, it's
Yeah, I've
not
had
a case of,
that experience with my daughters as well. Like I'm the same. If they say someone's, you know, a teacher's this, I don't dismiss what they say. I know that they're capable of making those sound judgments, basically.
But then you know, I say school's a training ground, life's full of idiots. You're not
Yeah.
going to get away from them. So there's
Yeah.
nothing you can do about it. It's just what you have to do is you have to control your own reaction to hearing things you don't like or being told things you don't like, because we can't go around changing everybody. So my kid, I just say you have to deal with it. It's just, you know, it's life.
So I'm interested in two things that you've mentioned. First,
Okay.
what's the type of psychotherapy that you got into? Because you said that it was a certain type.
Yeah, so it's transcendental, it's called. It's with a company called ClearMind, a Canadian company. They do a lot of the learning was online, but the in-person workshops. Yeah, so it's that kind of, yeah, psychotherapy. Really, really, really good.
I practice transcendental meditation. I don't know if there's any
Oh, right.
to the two.
Yeah. I've got a really great experience of doing some of that. I mean, this is why I stopped training from
Go
doing
on.
transcendental meditation. I got to the end of my second year, and we did this hour-long meditation where some people just think it's weird when I say this, but I feel it and I believe it. So you kind of start where you are in your life now, and it takes you back on a journey throughout all your life. So you're going backwards, people, places, things, jobs, feelings, and you go back to the point like preconception, you know, when you're a soul. And what you actually get to is the place that what your soul was intended for. And everyone's come out of this meditation going, oh, I know I need to be a psychotherapist. It's like I was born to be a psychotherapist. And I come out of it, and it's like I've got jazz hands and I'm on a stage. I am happy. But it was so real. Now, I'm not saying for a minute I'm going to be a dancer at my age, but it was very much about it was a stage, it was a platform. It was like you're in the wrong place. And I never continued because I'm not supposed to be a psychotherapist. But I think the learning, and because I paid quite a lot of money, I don't think I could have actually said, right, I'm going to spend X amount of money on my own therapy. I think I felt I had to do it because I thought I was going to help other people. I didn't really have that level of self-love. And I think how it's transpired is it was all for me, but I couldn't set off with the, oh yeah, this is just for me. So, right, kids, you know, get what's in fridge for your tea on a Tuesday night. I can't get you from school. I can't talk to you. I'm going to be at uni, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think I needed to badge it up as I'm doing this so I can help others. When in actual fact, it was, you know, it was just to help me and kind of set me off on my own path, really, of perhaps what I'm going to be when I grow up.
So did you have that experience before you got your MBE or after you got your MBE?
This was just after the MBE.
Okay.
This was just after. Yeah, probably about 3 months after, because I've always lived. I mean, I'm not. I'm recently separated. But I've been a mum since I was 17, and then, you know, kind of long relationships, if you will. And I think some of it, where I am now, is almost like, right, I'm 47 years old. What you're going to do with your life? What are you going to do? Not what you're going to do for others, you know. Not what kind of wife are you going to be? What kind of mother are you going to be? Who are you going to be to everyone at work? Because I mean, we've grown such a big organization now. We've got about 80 staff. You know, we started off as a group of people in recovery, thinking, "Yay, it'd be really nice to make friends and have some, you know, a service out of ours." And we've kind of grown this beast, really, which I have quite a prominent position in, and but that's fine. That's work. So I'm just in this, right? What does this next sort of like 20, 30 years really look like for me?
So I'm going to see you on Emmerdale basically in the next few years.
Not gonna see. Are you shy? I'm no actress.
The Javans thing
No, I think it was
came.
just a platform. It was just almost like I've got this vision of myself going, ta-da! Like I'm here, because I've always been a bit, I'm like a house cat. So even at home, I'm a real home bird. And then at work, I sit comfortably behind the scenes, where a lot of people really don't know who I am and they don't know what I do. And, you know, but I'm just there kind of like tinkering away, you see. And I think I've been comfortable doing that, but I also know I've sold out doing that because there's been a bit of fear about taking up space and about perhaps stepping forward and, you know, stepping into like my own power and that kind of stuff. So I think this time that's what this is about, really. So I don't know. I don't know where I'm gonna be. You might go, oh, she was on my podcast about a year ago.
Now look at
Look at her now.
her.
Well, let's all, I mean, I don't even know what that means, but yeah.
Maybe this is your platform, the beginning.
Maybe. Who knows? Who
When
knows?
I go viral, I'll be viral with your
Yeah. Oh no, they'll just be like, oh God, I don't know. I always sound like I'm talking through my nose as well, but I'll have to get used to that.
Where are you in the world, by the way? I'm taking you near Leeds-ish. York.
No, I'm near Leeds. I'm in
No?
Heacham, near Lancaster.
Oh, Lancaster, okay.
So where are you?
Well, I'm in the Midlands, but I'm from Manchester
Midlands.
originally.
All
So,
right, okay.
just because I lived in Leeds for 10 years, I'm from Lancashire, but I lived in Yorkshire, and I never quite have accents like when I'm speaking to people either.
Yeah, well, I've lived here most of my life. I was born here, so it's by the coast. I'm right by the coast, so yeah, it's a really nice part of the world.
So the second question that I got from what you were saying earlier is also, so what was your, so fellowships wise, was it NA or AA, and what was
It
your
was
ex?
NA and then it was AA.
Okay, and what was your experience of it like overall?
Ooh. I mean, positively, I understood. Hang on. Positively, I will still use some of the program in my life today. I understood what was wrong with me in relation to drink and drugs. I made some amazing friends, absolutely amazing friends who I'm still best mates with today, you know, who I'm still accountable to, you know, the friends who will tell me if I'm a little bit off my head or if I need to pipe down or, you know, any of those things. They might want to check me thinking around stuff. Yeah, I had some quite negative experiences. I think there's a lot goes on in the fellowships that people don't talk about and should talk about.
Such as.
Oh, see, well, I'm just going to say it. I think there's quite a lot of predatory people in fellowships, and I think it doesn't get spoken about. I think there's a lot of safeguarding that gets raised. There's a lot of things that are held that shouldn't be held. You know, we're not therapists, you know, in that environment. I think there's a lot of misguided people. I think there's a lot of narcissists. I think there's a lot of really, really, really poorly people. I got quite fed up of, you know, same messages, not to do with me. I'm there to carry a message. I wouldn't ordinarily sit in a room with people like that. You know, there were some people who I felt very, very uncomfortable sitting in a room with. That's my stuff. You know, these meetings still go on to thrive, and you know, they're still serving people. I don't like some of the messaging, whereas where you leave, it's you're the problem, which I think reinforces a lot of trauma in people. There are some people who can't get it. There are some people who need nurturing a hell of a lot more than they get nurturing. Some of the messaging is brutal. It is absolutely brutal that. Should you feel any way, you're not praying enough, you're not good enough, you're not inventory enough, you're not giving enough of your time away. And I think early days, you know, when you're on realignment, because I think we do, I mean, there's an element of brainwashing, I do believe that, but I think my brain needed washing because where I got to in my addiction and what I never really thought was okay, but I couldn't stop doing certain things. And then the hurts to myself and others, you know, really got worse. So, but I think some of the messaging, and I don't necessarily believe it's the fellowships. I think it's some of the personalities, you know, that are sat within the fellowship. So I think the literature in and of itself, much prefer AA literature. I think AA, it's about getting a relationship with a higher power. I think NA probably creates a dependency on people, and people struggle to make decisions, you know, because of that dependency. It takes much longer to do the work. Get through the AA work in about 9 to 10 weeks if you've got a decent sponsor, and you do get your awakening, you do get your brainwashed, you do have a program for living and personally. But then I see there's lots of people coming through and they are getting clean. I don't see a lot of people sticking around though, to be honest. I don't, you know, with the NA fellowship, don't really see a lot of people. There seems to be, you get to about 8 or 9 years, people leave, and then there might be that middle part. You might get people about 17, 18 years. I think a lot of people jump off. That's the impression that I get. Yeah, I think there's a lot of scaremongering, but you know, it kickstarted my journey. Would I refer people there? Absolutely. But I would also encourage you if you wanted to leave as well, if you felt like that was the right thing to do, because we don't die. You know, I'm thriving. I've never done as well in my life, and I think from an achievement point of view, I've always wanted to achieve, and I don't mean materialistically. Just want to achieve. I've got a brain. You know, I always think, what's next? What can I do next? What can I do next? Because I kind of want to make the most of a couple of things, really. From the background that I've come from, I like to kind of like challenge stigmas and stuff, because people, this doesn't happen to people like me. And I think that's what the MBE was about. It was like, oh, wow, you know, I'm recovering heroin addicts. I got an MBE. I think studying, you know, getting a degree, business, you know, that kind of stuff. I just like to, there's a part of it that is challenging of stigmas, but also getting rid of the glass ceilings, you know, that are placed on you, if achievement is something that you want. You know, I think it's dead important.
What did you get your MBA for?
For services to my community, it was in the pandemic, so Services to community. So I've worked in Morecambe since 2015. We set up the well in Lancaster in 2012, brought the services to Morecambe in 2015, and there was quite a lot of innovation, you know, in the pandemic, because obviously you've got a team of us, a team of ex-drug addicts and alcoholics going, shit, imagine being an addict in this. What would you do? It was desperate. We felt the desperation for people straight away, and we could just see services, you know, closing the doors. And relationship, I think the big thing for us is relationship, and it's about connection. If you can feel connected to somebody or something and not judged, and you can be given some hope in that, that is literally all people need. Well, shutting your doctors, shutting your hospitals, shutting your services, it's no wonder mental health kind of skyrocketed. You know, mental health concerns seem to take over drug problems and alcohol problems. So we just come up with loads of different ways of, you know, getting to people. And but ultimately it was, yeah, services to that community, which I mean, down the road from where my office is, I used to live in a bed sit and kick the windows in when I was on Valium, you know, when I was about 18. It's like I was an absolute bloody nuisance, you know, in that area. So it's like, oh, you know, it's nice to give something back, you know, to the
Yeah,
area. And
literally giving something back to the area.
literally giving, so yeah, that's it, literally giving something back. And just a bit of hope as well, because I was hopeless. I was completely hopeless. I was a bloody nuisance. So yeah, but it's quite rare. I mean, I don't suppose you can ever have it on your bucket list. I never thought for a minute that I would ever get one. But it's nice. You know, it's not, and I think it's good for lived experience as well. You know, that it's recognised, you know, as a thing, and we do have a really unique way of doing things, and we can absolutely add value to the treatment system. Definitely not clinically. You know, I wouldn't want to get involved in anything clinical, but moving people along, inspiring hope, bringing people into service, getting them out of service. Absolutely, I think it's something that we do exceptionally well.
That's amazing and well done.
Yeah,
Congratulations.
thanks. Thank you.
It's interesting what you said about the whole, because I can't really comment on NA because I've never been part of that fellowship.
Okay.
I've been to meet, but I have kind of, I've looked at the green and gold and I've sponsored people that have come from NA to AA. And I've always been quite heavily involved in AA, but at the same time, kind of since the pandemic, I suppose, I wouldn't say I've backed off because I do still go to meetings, but at the same time, I do see all the stuff that you're talking about. And for me, it's kind of like the actual structure of the fellow, well, specifically that fellowship is great, but fortunately, people don't always adhere to the principles of the fellowship and the program, and personalities take over, egos take over, people run meetings in ways that they probably shouldn't, etc., etc. It's just a very human thing. It's a very human problem because at the end of the day, like you said, initially when we first come into fellowships, we're all very unwell people, mentally, physically, emotionally. So there is a lot of that kind of predatory behavior that can happen, people that are unwell, and especially, women coming into the fellowship need to be careful. That's why they say men work with men, women work with women. So I have, I've definitely experienced all that stuff, but I suppose the reason why I keep going back and what it's given me, and I think what it also gave you, is a very solid foundation in a spiritual life
Absolutely.
and some sort of faith in something bigger than myself. So that's what I wanted to ask you next, really, is like, what is that kind of like for you now? Like, what is your spiritual life like?
I mean, my spiritual life, it is everything. I mean, that compass, I think, was always in there, that kind of like measure. So what I learned to tap into in fellowship has probably been speaking to me since I was about 6 years old, but I didn't know that that's what it was. You know, I just kind of had this internal sort of narrative, really. I remember all through my life, I would have this voice that would tell me, this isn't it, Kerry, this isn't it, this isn't it. It's just for now. And even, you know, 15-year heroin addiction, I knew I wasn't going to die of it. I just knew I wasn't going to die of it. And despite what was going on at home, I just knew that wasn't it. So I think what the fellowship did, because I've been to church loads of times, but I always struggled to build up meaningful relationships, particularly with women in church, because churches aren't full of women like me. They might be full of men a little bit similar to me, but you're a bit of an anomaly if you go in and you've been a heroin addict and you've had two kids in addiction and you've done all the things. And it's like you almost, it's one of those make yourself small because we can't quite handle, what it is that you've got to say. But a man comes in, it's like he's like Christ-like. They celebrate the men from prison and the 25-year criminals and stuff. And I'd be like, all right, like I've had the same, but they're not interested and they don't really have the space, to open that stuff up. So I think what fellowship for me did was really opened, it really opened up my spiritual life really and helped me tap into something, that was already there that had been guiding me to a certain extent. And I think now it's everything, my conscience is absolutely everything. And this is why, uncomfortable conversations, in order to stay true to that conscience, you've got to say stuff that hurts and you've got to say stuff that's really going to hurt people. Because I think, not intentionally, but I think that's all part of staying really on the straight and narrow.
Truth.
Yeah.
Truth.
Yeah, truth. Yeah, truth. And for me, it's about I don't mind being in disagreeing with 20 people. If it's right, it's right. If every part of me is going, oh, you don't actually believe what they're saying, and anyone asks, what do you think? If you can ask me what I think, I don't agree. And here's the reasons. And I think it's the freedom. I think it's the freedom to be. It's not even like a freedom to be. I absolutely have to be me today. And if you don't find me palatable, that's your problem. But what I won't do is not be myself, to make my presence, easier for you. So I think that's really what a spiritual life does. And I do genuinely think, there is a plan. There is a plan for my life. And, part of what I've been going through over the last few months and, there's a plan and I absolutely trust that there's a plan.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
like that. Yeah. What kind of practices, what kind of spiritual practices do you adhere to these days, if any?
I mean, prayer. It's prayer. It's prayer. It's meditation. That's what a lot of it is. I mean, I've done a lot of going to church. Don't go to church anymore because again, kind of struggle, kind of put my church face on. I can't really necessarily say it's meaningful. Can't say half the stuff I want to say because I'm quite unfiltered a lot of the time, which I like about myself now. Because you get to a certain age and you go, I couldn't give a shit what anyone else. And I don't mean it. As in, I can say what I want and I can do what I want, but I'm more concerned with what I think about myself than what you think about me these days. Churches aren't always the right environment. I'm probably a bit too real. But I do still pray. It's prayer. Yeah.
And
Every
so essentially you kind of live in your authentic self, live in
day. Oh
your
yeah. Yeah. That would probably be one thing that probably anyone who knows me probably says about me, I'm probably about as real as it gets, and you'll always know where you stand. Good
get that impression.
or bad. Good or bad.
What does life in recovery mean to you?
Oh, what does life in recovery? This is one of our interview questions, and it's funny no one's ever asked me this. So we always ask people, what does a life beyond your wildest dreams look like in recovery? And this is usually a good values-based question. So what does life in recovery mean to
This
me?
is my question for my
Right,
podcast.
I know, but I'm going, shit, I've just had one of your questions thrown back on me.
Your interview hinges on this question, Kerry. You're
I've failed because I've lost
either
it.
going to be platformed or you're not going to be platformed.
I'm honestly, no, I'm going down. What does it mean? I think it means peace. It means self-respect. It means hope. It means possibility. It means capacity to love. It's to be loved. To be resilient, opportunities, just it's yeah, it's great. Life in recovery. It's travel, it's things as well. And this is not what a lot of people don't talk about. I always really wanted a really nice house and I've got one, and that's all right. And I like driving a really nice car, and that's all right because I work really hard. I like going on holidays, and that's all right. So I go on holidays. And I think it's about, I still think it's about being charitable. I still think it's about giving your time. I think it's about not forgetting where you've come from. But it's actually all right to move away from where you've come from. Because I think if you're always measuring yourself against, you're not picking up cigarettes off the floor anymore. You almost put a glass ceiling on yourself, and it's like, yeah, I've done that. That's in me. But if you look back too much, I think it can limit your growth. So I think there's something about, I think you can have what you want. Life and recovery is you can have whatever you want, but be prepared to work twice as hard to keep hold of it.
I love that. You like this story. So you're talking about prayer and things coming to you. So the other day, I was just praying casually, and I was like, "Come on, big man, I need to get, because I've got like, so I've been I go to the gym and I do weights and stuff, and I do jiu-jitsu, but I wanted to get a weights bar with weights on it. For we're moving house soon, so when we get this new house, I'm gonna have like a bit of a gym at the bottom of the garden and stuff. And I wanted to get this weights bar, but I've got no money at the moment. I'm skint. I've like spent all my money. I'm like saving up to move house and all the rest of it. So I was like, I really, really want to get this weights bar. And also, I could do with like a couple of grand or something. Like I'm just skint. I need a bit of money.
Absolutely.
Anyway,
Perfect.
couple of days later, I'm stood outside playing with my daughter with a little electric car that she's got for her birthday. And the next door neighbor shouts me over. He says, "Hey, John," he says, "you got a minute?" I said, "Yeah, no problem." He said, "I seen a video that you posted online the other day of you doing some weights." He said, "I've got some weights in the house. Do you want them?" And
Wow.
I said, "Of course, yeah." He said, "It's like a weights bar. We wait." I said, "Yeah, I'll
There
definitely have
you
that." Yeah. So
go.
he
There you
goes and
go.
gets them. We bring them over to put them in my garage. As I'm walking out the garage, he says, "I've got another thing." He said, "Another thing to run by you." He said, "How do you fancy making a few quid?" And I said, "Yeah, of course." So anyway, long story short, tells me about this thing that he's been doing, this kind of like tax rebate thing. He's made a couple of £1,000 off it. He said, "If I refer you, I get 100 quid, and you'll get up to 2 grand."
There
So
you go.
I was like, this morning, I'm on the phone to this guy rings me. I'm on the phone. I said, "Is this legit?" He was like, "Yeah, it's legit." Went through it, goes through the whole HMRC. It took me about 15 minutes. I said, "How much am I going to get back for this?" He said, "Anything up to about 2 grand, mate." So I was like, I
There you
mean,
go. And it's if you don't ask, you don't get.
exactly. I mean, and it's not very often I ask for these material things, but
No. But I think we can. I think we can. And I think they've got to be looked after, and I think they've got to be earned. And I'm not saying for a minute get yourself into debt for anything, but why wouldn't you want the nice things? It's like, why we don't get clean to get skint, do we? To not have hope. Because gratitude can take you so far. And I think as long as it's woven through everything, but yeah, ask.
And all this coincides. It's not like I'm not doing the other stuff as well. So, like I am praying for people, I am meditating, I am helping others, I am doing that in my
There
job.
you go.
It's like I'm
But
doing all the
you've been
things I'm
blessed.
doing.
You've been blessed. You've asked. You've been blessed, and it's like we've got to take the blessings, haven't we? That's the way I see things. I've really been blessed, and I'm going to take the blessings because I deserve the blessings.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I always said to my wife earlier, I said, I always feel uncomfortable like talking about God, as in, like what God is, and I usually use the word higher power. But there's definitely something. I don't care what people say, and I think that it's becoming much more socially acceptable to say that now. Like
Of
every
course it is.
most people have got some concept of a higher power, whether it's religious, spiritual. And everybody seems to be acknowledging that, like, there's something more going on.
But there's something about manifesting, isn't there? I think one of the younger kind of non-recovery generation, I mean, my daughter, she's 24. She'll be like, you manifested that, Mum. That's, so she calls it manifestation. I might call it prayer or something. It's answered prayer. But I think the idea is what you're saying. It's like people are tapped into the notion that the universe will provide, and we can have really what we're asking for. But I think you do have to work really hard to keep it. I think that's my ex. You can have what you want,
Guess
but
what? We've just changed clubs from our jiu-jitsu team, and we've moved from one big, massive brand to another brand, and it's called Manifest Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
there you go.
But that's because the guy that who's my coach, Johnny, and shout out to Johnny and the rest of the team. He's exactly the same. He says exactly the same. He said, "I've manifested this." He
There
said,
you
"I've
go.
always wanted to have my own jiu-jitsu club, and I've manifested this, and it's happened, and it's real."
And this is how it's been for me over the last 6 months. So a recent manifestation of mine is business coaching. I would love to be a business coach. I think the stuff that I've learned, through building the well and just the richness really of experience. I'm a really, really good troubleshooter. Really, really good problem solver. So yeah, I liked, you know, Alan shows you know, the apprentice, you know, the early days, and there'd be Alan, there'd be Claude, and there'd be Margaret. Do you remember? Well, Claude, I like to think of myself as a bit of Claude, you know, like he's troubleshooter. And then I've kind of gone with that idea, and the amount of things that have literally fallen on my lap where I've been asked to do it for people as like a bit of as a dummy run, really. Some coaching has kind of, you know, dropped on my lap. I delivered some training yesterday, and everything about the training is going, it's here. You're doing it. You're actually doing it. So it's crazy, and I just put that out to the universe, like. Somebody had asked me, in an ideal world, what job would you be doing? And I said, I'd be Claude Littner. And then it's kind of so. Anyway, if Alan Sugar actually gets around to watching this,
That'll be your platform. That'll be your platform.
everybody sat next to
Gonna go on The Apprentice if you
him.
can
There you
pass.
go, and it's going to be me.
And then you're gonna give me a shout out. You're gonna come back to it. And you're gonna say, I remember John Littner's
100%.
podcast. But you won't believe this. This is the God's honest truth. Last Monday, I just got my results for my professional coaching apprenticeship. So I'm now a professional co business coach.
Oh, there you go.
Actually, if you want, after this, I'll send you the
Yeah.
link so you can
Yeah.
do it for your business.
Yeah, no, that would be really good. So I've been looking at some NLP stuff, yeah, through NLP, and I think what I need is resources, because I think, and this is another reason why I can't be a therapist, because I'm really good at telling people what to do, and I think that's because I'm an eldest child, whereas therapists can't tell people what to do, and I'm sat there going, I can fucking solve all your problems in the next 5 minutes, but you're not allowed to do that. So I think coaching is it's really, really directive. And I think I read something yesterday, and it said coaches are, I think it's magicians, which help people rearrange the hands that they've been dealt to serve them better. And I thought, that's it. That's
Beautiful.
it. And yeah, so hopefully, in the not so distant future, I'll yeah, we'll
I'll send
see.
you some info after this, because
That'd be really good.
you might be able to go down that route. Well,
Yeah.
thank you very much for today. It's been great
Oh,
having
thanks.
a chat with you. I really enjoyed it, and
Oh, it's been great. Nice to meet
all
you.
the best for the future.
Absolutely. And I will await your resources, John.
Okay, no problem.
All right. Thank you.